Accession number 18344, Reel 2.
Richard Pete, Reel 2. You were just telling me that your comrades don't mention El Tahag at reunions nowadays.
No. I think it's because of the atrocious condition that we suffered.
Was this 1948?
That's right, yes, 1948.
What kind of duties were you supposed to have at El Tahag?
Well, the only things we did there were perimeter guards and main gate guards. And it just seemed to consist of mainly 24 hours on, 24 hours off. And it was all guard duty. It wasn't a very pleasant place at all. There was no... You were constantly cleaning. As I say, your kit was always covered in dust. The tent was always full of fine sand. Your weapons were always needed cleaning.
How long did you stay there for then?
It was a few months. I can't tell you how long. I've forgotten the dates. Elude me now with my age, you know. But we stayed a few months, and then the order came through that we're going back to England, or to Britain. So we got on. We went to Portishead by trucks and train and trucks to Portishead. And then we were put on landing craft and we were taken out to, I think it was called the Empire Fowey, troop ship. And we set off for Scotland. And we landed in Scotland. And in Glasgow. We disembarked and then we got on the train to Edinburgh. And then we all, once we landed in Edinburgh, got our kit sorted out, we were all sent on leave. So we had a 1 month leave, which was an enjoyable time. I reported back to Edinburgh, and then the battalion moved down to Colchester. And we went into Sir Brian Barracks. Sir Brian Barracks in Colchester was a place where you could do proper soldiering. They had real army barracks, real army squares, armories, canteens, a normal barracks. And we started as peacetime soldiers.
What kind of duties were at Sir Brian Barracks?
Well, it was army training that we continued with weapon training. We got issue with our dress kilts and tunics and things like that. And we had ceremonial guards, ceremonial duties. I was there when the present Queen was a princess and came to visit the battalion. She was Colonel in Chief. And I was on parade there when she came. And things like that, you know. And Commanding Officers Parade, Adjutant Parade, RSM's Parade, all the regular army routine.
How did you like that?
I was happy. I was happy in Colchester, yes. I enjoyed the regular army routine. It was nice to be back in Britain where you could go out at night, and if you weren't on duty. You go to the pictures and shows and things like that, which there was none of them sort of things in El Tahag and places like that, you know.
How did the soldiers behave in Colchester?
Just normal, drunk and things like that, you know. Normal sort of, it was a garrison town, you remember, you know. There was drinking and fighting and things like that, you know, just normal soldiers. shall I say, a soldier's way of life, if you like, you know.
Did the soldiers make a nuisance of themselves?
No, I would think it was that bad. There'd be disturbances in pubs, you know, and not a lot. No, it wasn't bad, really. There was military police and the civil police, but I don't think they had a lot to do. It was only incidents rather than... There was nothing mass about it, you know, just incidents and things like that. Just normal garrison troops, you know. I think it occurs everywhere, you know.
Did you get involved in anything?
Oh, no, I was a good lad. No. By this time, I've been promoted to Lance Corporal. So I was very proud, and then I got promoted to Corporal. So you kind of keep yourself out of trouble when you do that, you know.
So how did you come to go to Hong Kong?
Well, in 1949, Mae So Tung was sweeping through China, driving the Nationalist Army in front of him, and I think the British government were worried that he may attack the colony of Hong Kong. So the battalion was put on board troop ship and posted to Hong Kong, supposedly to guard the colony from Mae So Tung attacking it. When we got there, we went first to the island of Hong Kong, and we were stationed in a barracks up in Stanley. And then we were only there to get acclimatised and trouble kit and things like that. And then we were sent into the New Territories, which is part of mainland China, through Kowloon into the territories. And once we got into the territories, we started digging defensive positions, trenches, communicating trenches. And then it was decided that we would march all over this and new territories, so we were familiar with the land. So we moved from one part of the new territory to the other, so everybody knew exactly where they were at any given time. It was all right. I didn't like the digging bit, and it had a clammy atmosphere. You all seemed to be wet, you know, sweat. And but the when you weren't on duty and you went down into Hong Kong, it was that was an admirable station. It was really nice, Hong Kong. It had all the facilities that. That anyone required, civilians or soldiers. There was clubs, nightclubs, cinemas, pubs, bars. You know, it was really the shopping was really good. It was supposed to be. It was termed at that time. It was the shop window of the Far East, where all the goods from the world seemed to be centralised. Watches were very cheap. Clothes were cheap, shoes, anything like that, very cheap, you know. And we kind of lived a good life for a while there, you know. It was really a good station. I think it's one of the best stations I've ever been in Hong Kong. I enjoyed that.
Did the soldiers have much to do with the civilians?
Yeah, all friendly civilians. Some of the, not a lot, but one or two of the soldiers married civilians. But, yeah, they were quite friendly with us, the Chinese, Hong Kong Chinese. Yeah, we got on well with them.
What was the attitude of the officers in the battalion towards soldiers marrying Hong Kong girls?
Well, I don't think they liked it at all. They'd gone marrying one of the native population. No, I don't think they liked it at all. If you wanted to get married, you had to go to the commanding officer and ask his permission. Whether he granted it or not was entirely up to the way the commanding officer saw the situation.
Did you know of anybody who had to do that?
Not personally, no. It was said among in the barrack room, if you did meet a Chinese girl which you felt like you wanted to marry, that was the procedure you would have to go through. You'd have to see your platoon officer and tell him what you were doing, then it would go on the company commander, and then it would go eventually to the commanding officer, who would make the final decision whether you could get married or not. Whether that was army rules or I don't know, or government rules, I don't know, but I never did. I never bothered with anything like that, you know. So I don't know whether they... I didn't know anybody personally that did it. Whether it was hard to get married to one of the local girls or what, I don't know.
Were there any disturbances in Hong Kong whilst you were there?
No, not that I know of, no. It's quite good.
Did you think that the communists would cross into Hong Kong?
At the time, I wasn't sure. I'd thought about it really, whether they would or not. If they had done, I would have had to do my duty. But I don't think they would have done.
Now, can you tell me about how the battalion got the call to go to Korea?
Well, it was in August 1950. That the North Koreans earlier that year had invaded South Korea, and the occupation American army in South Korea and the South Korean army had retreated in front of this North Korean army till they were right down to the, as you know, Korea is a peninsula, they were right at the toe of Korea, and they were in what was termed then the Pusan perimeter. Pusan was the port of South Korea, and it seemed like that they were going to get chased out of Korea altogether at that stage, when the United Nations stepped in and decided to send ground troops. The Argyle and Sutherland Islanders and the Middlesex Regiment were stationed in Hong Kong, and they were the nearest British troops for to Korea. So we were put on board the HMS Ceylon, and the Middlesex Regiment were put on board the HMS Unicorn, which was an aircraft carrier, and we sailed for Pusan. I think that was in August 1950.
What was the voyage like?
We were packed like sardines. It had a full battalion of troops on board, and I think it was only a cruiser. And we were living below decks with the sailors. We had hammocks and tabletops, and on the floor a sleeping arrangement. I remember one occasion when we were in the South China Seas, they had the radar, which had got a blimp or something off, something underneath the water, and we were battened down in the living quarters. They fastened us down, and they went on to action stations, the Navy. Anyway, it was a false alarm, so we were all right. They opened the hatches again, thinking we were allowed. We weren't allowed freedom of the ship, but we were allowed to move about, you know, to a certain extent. But we were only on it a few days, and then we landed in Pusan, and we disembarked on the docks, and the American army, what was left in it, was lying in all the dock side, you know, and in the warehouses and things like that. We formed up on parade, and we marched to a railway station, boarded the train, and we were off to the front. Same day landing. We got as near as the front as we could on this train, then we disembarked, and we got in trucks, and we went right up to the edge of the Nakdong River, which was then called the Nakdong perimeter. And we climbed some hills and dug in. And in front of us was a valley with a river running through it, the River Nakdong. The other side of the Nak Tong was a Korean army, and we were at this side. And we dug in, got ourselves established, and then we started off doing patrols. And we were down into this valley and patrol the valley floor. On one occasion, my sergeant, Sergeant O'Sullivan, was leading a fighting patrol, and we had to ford the river and see if we could bring back a Korean prisoner for interrogation. We forded the river, we went and we patrolled the other side, but we never saw any sign of life whatsoever. So we returned back, and the sergeant made a report. We then came through the day. We were subject to artillery fire and machine gun fire coming across the river. And then they decided, I think it was September, early September, that they were going to break out and cross the Nak Tong River. So the Americans built one of them pontoon bridges, and we crossed the river and headed north.
Were you still in B Company?
Yes, I was a corporal in B Company.
Which platoon were you in?
Six.
Do you remember which section you were in?
I don't really see. Maybe 1, 2, 3. I don't really know. No, I was in. See. I think about 9 section. I'm not sure though, but platoon commander was Lieutenant Hunter, and the platoon sergeant was Sergeant O'Sullivan. There was 2 more corporals, Corporal MacDonald and Corporal Sweeney, Bob Sweeney. Anyway, when we went across the river, it was decided that there was a hill called 282. And this hill would be attacked, a dawn attack, by B and C companies. So we lined up on the 23rd of September, it was, I'll never forget that day. And we decided to attack this hill. So we got an extended line. And we forded a small river, and we started climbing 282. I think we got about halfway up, and we came under fire from some small arm fire from some trees. The first section went in and cleared the trees. And we started climbing again, and we got a bit farther, and then we came under small arm fire again, which looked like another section of these North Korean troops. I would assume they were in section strength, where they'd been sent to guard their forward slopes. We got going again, and then suddenly we came under pretty heavy fire. Joe first got wounded. He got shot in the tummy. And I put him against a tree and a cigarette in his mouth. I left him for the ambulance people, you know, first aid people to pick him up. We just went a bit further on, and the platoon commander went down. He was shot in his feet. And by this time, there was constant fire, and then it stopped. We kept going to the top of the hill. When we got to the top of the hill, it had like a double top. When we got to the top, there was a small valley like that, and it went up again into another small hill. And the strange thing was, in the valley, there was a North Korean platoon having their breakfast. They were eating rice out of baskets. And all that noise and fire that had been going on, they were calmly eating their breakfast. So Paddy O'Sullivan, he set up an atom, and we went down into this valley, and Paddy went down with them. 2 bullets in his groin, and then Big Bob Sweeney took command, and we followed Bob up to the second hill, where the a number of that Korean platoon had been eliminated. They'd retreated back up to the second little hill, and we were climbing up that towards them. They were throwing grenades down at us, shooting small arms fire, and eventually we captured the top of the hill. Because of that action, Corporal Sweeney won a military medal. We stayed on top of the little hill, and then Sergeant Major Murray arrived, and he said he'd been in Company HQ at the back, and he said, prepare for a counterattack. On the left-hand side was a gully, and the North Korean Army was coming up this gully, and 4 platoon and 5 platoon were facing this gully. So they were all in these North Korean, I'm led to believe it was in battalion strength, were attacking these 2 platoons of Argyles. I was on top of this hill, and it came under machine gun fire because it was overlooked from another hill, but we didn't know that at the time when we attacked the first hill. But anyway, it was overlooked with this machine gun, and it was raking the top of that hill with machine gun fire. I slid down off the top of the hill, and when I got in that little valley at the bottom again, Sergeant Bell, I think he was 5 platoon, was lying on the floor, and he was wounded, and he said to me, you better get back up there or we'll get overwhelmed. I went back up again. When I got to the top, Sergeant Major Murray was, come back down. There was machine gun bullets flying. Why I didn't get it, I don't know. I slid back down into the valley, and Sergeant Major Murray said, we're sending for air support. We've asked for an air support. And he said, I want you to come up the top here and help me with these recognition panels. So the air recognition panels were laid out in the form of St. Andrew's Cross. One was orange and one was crimson. They were golden, like golden crimson, you know. And they were laid out in the form of St. Andrew's Cross. I went back into the valley, and Sergeant Bell was still lying there, and I went back up to the hill, on top of the hill, and I was lying down looking into this gully and firing at any movement that I saw. I had a rifle at the time, firing a rifle. The machine gun, which was overlooking us, for some reason had stopped firing onto the top of that hill, and it was a 25, well, it was a, there was like a, what do they call, like a self-propelled gun zeroed onto the top of the hill, and these shells were exploding on top of the hill. Then suddenly 2 aircraft appeared. They went over the top of the edge, and we thought at the time, in that minute, that they were going to attack this gully where the North Korean army was coming up, and 4 platoon and 5 platoon were trying to hold them back. And as I sat there watching this airplane, it dropped this thing, I didn't know what it was, and it was a napalm bomb, and it dropped on the top of 4 platoon and 5 platoon, and just went like that. And I'm later led to believe we had 60 casualties in 2 minutes. At the end of the day, we had 90 casualties, and we were just, they just decimated them 2 platoons. And they dropped another one, which was gradually spreading to the top, and it stopped short of this little hill where Willie Watts was firing a Bren gun, and I joined him on top of the hill with a 303 rifle, and Willie Watts got awarded the American Bronze Star for that, gallantry medal. Then suddenly we started pulling back because the company had been decimated with these 2 napalm bombs. And as we drew back, the aeroplanes circulated round, and they came in and they started machine gun us, and like cannon shells. These two, they were 2 propeller driven aeroplanes, American. And they machine gunned us, and we were all lying flat on the floor, and cannon shells. And then they just flew off. But the hill was on fire. There was lads lying everywhere, wounded, burnt. was terrible. That's one day I'll never forget. When he said to me earlier on, did anything affect me? That day did affect me. It's never gone out of my mind, that day was terrible. To see our girls on an island running about on fire, you know, covered in that petroleum jelly, which was, it was terrible. Anyway, we picked as many lads up as we could. And I remember going over the top of that first hill, and there was a young fella sitting underneath an overhang of rock. I don't know who he is. I didn't know who he was, I don't know who he is yet. And the skin on his face had come off like a surgical glove. And he said to me, he used to call me Dickie at the time, Dickie, is my face all right? And I said to him, yes. I didn't know who he was, because the old skin had come off. And I said to him, don't stay there, lad, because we can't hold them Koreans and they're overwhelming us, so you better come with me. He said, all right. Anyway, I started going down the hill, and when I looked back, he was still sitting there. He wouldn't move. He must have been terrifying. And at that point, Major Muir arrived, who was the second in command of the battalion. And he rounded us up and said, come on, we're not being driven off this hill. And I still think there was about 30 of us. So we went back again and we attacked the hill and we recaptured it again. But the North Koreans was an overwhelming force. We couldn't hold them. We were running short of ammunition and it was becoming drastic. And then suddenly Major Muir fell with an automatic burst of fire across his chest, and he was dead. So at that stage we left. We started going back down the hill. On the way down, I found a young man with his kneecap blown off. So I got all the two or three other lads who were with me, and we picked this man up and put him in a ground sheet, and we carried him down the hill. And when we got to the bottom, well, the funny thing was, all flies were landing on his, you know, the raw flesh. So I took my shirt off and I covered his kneecap up so the flies wouldn't get at it. I thought, you know, they'll contaminate it, you know, make his wound bad. And he kept saying to me, look, Dickie, I can move my foot, there's nothing wrong. But what he didn't know, his whole kneecap had gone. And it was through the movement of the ground sheet he was being carried in that his foot was moving. But he thought he was doing it, but he wasn't. Anyway, we got him to the bottom of the hill. And as we were going down the hill, there were some Korean soldiers following us. And they kept shooting at us with small arms fire. And at the bottom of the hill, we met Captain Slim, who was the adjutant. And we shouted to him that we were men following us down and attacking us. And he attacked. He said, there's a man behind, and he shot these North Koreans. And we went back into the battalion headquarters, and that was the end of that day. And I would say to you, that was the worst day of my life. And we had, out of two companies of men, we had 90 casualties. So the battalion was reformed by volunteers from the continent of the Black Watch, the Gordon Islanders, and other regiments. And then once the battalion had been reinforced, we